insecticide all over the city, and the Green Party is suing. Also, the chair of the Republican National Committee urges Patrick Buchanan to stay in the party. We'll look at the history and politics of the conservative. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This news from Tasitolu, East Timor. Reporters discovered 10 charred bodies in a burned-out pickup truck just west of Dili Airport. A witness told Reuters the victims were murdered by Indonesian police and pro-Jakarta militiamen about 2 weeks ago in a sandy lot full of wrecked and abandoned vehicles. Recounted 38-year-old Alberto A.C. Pereira, a resident of the village of Tabar, "I was hiding with two other people on the hill above the place, and I saw them drive the truck in at about 7 o'clock in the morning." He went on to say the victims were tied up in the back of the truck. The militiamen hacked them to death with machetes. I could hear their screams from where I was on the hill. He said when the people were dead, the militiamen poured petrol on the bodies and the truck and set them on fire. There was no independent confirmation of Pereira's account, but it seemed roughly consistent with physical evidence reporters observed from the site. The fact that 10 bodies could lie undiscovered just off the main road between Dili and Lakisa and just a few kilometers from the airport revealed how little the international community yet knows about the situation on the ground in East Timor. With only 7,500 Interfet troops on call, about 4,000 of which are now deployed, the international community has managed to secure only the capital, Dili, in its first week of operations. Meanwhile, U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen warned Indonesia to shackle its military in East Timor as the bodies of more victims of pro-Jakarta militia violence surface today. On the eve of talks with Indonesian President B.J. Habibie and other leaders, Cohen urged Jakarta to stop troops supporting pro-Jakarta militias, which have been accused of killing thousands of East Timorese. The United Nations is preparing today to take up civilian duties in East Timor before it formally takes control. International authorities in Kosovo, fearing a new spiral of violence after a deadly grenade attack on a Serb marketplace, appealed today to the people of the territory to exercise restraint. Two Serbs, a man and a woman, were killed and more than 40 wounded in yesterday's attack south of the Kosovo capital, Pristina. This according to the United Nations, those injured by the two grenades were mainly elderly people. Although the tribunal could not hope to prosecute every low-level war criminal active in Kosovo, it would take a close interest in particularly heinous or notorious crimes, including crimes of sexual violence. Meanwhile, new UN war crimes prosecutor Carla Del Ponte set out her strategy on Kosovo today, narrowing her investigative focus to Yugoslavia's leaders and the perpetrators of only the most heinous crimes. The local justice system in Kosovo, under the aegis of the United Nations, would try cases that fell outside the scope of the International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia, as she defined it. Although the tribunal could not hope to prosecute every low-level war criminal active in Kosovo, it would take a close interest in particularly heinous or notorious crimes, including crimes of sexual violence. Political prisoners in jails across Turkey kept dozens of guards hostage for a fourth day today in protests against the deaths of 11 prisoners in an Ankara prison revolt at the weekend. In the capital, relatives of the dead and scores of protesters waited outside a morgue to receive the bodies after autopsies were completed. Armed gendarmerie troops stormed barricades erected by political prisoners in an Ankara jail on Sunday, leaving 11 prisoners dead of shotgun wounds and heavy blows. And finally, thousands of Turkish troops backed by air power have crossed into northern Iraq to hunt down Turkish Kurd rebels hiding out in the mountains there, according to Turkish officials. Some 5,000 troops crossed the rugged border at three separate points to reinforce soldiers already there in attack positions held by the Kurdistan Workers' Party. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners. I noticed in the Wall Street Journal yesterday that the lead article was about American home products, the pharmaceutical giant getting ready to settle for $4 billion, a series of suits having to do with one of its diet drugs. Well, it had one of the products in the Fen-Phen diet drug. It produced Pondamin, and apparently there are hundreds of lawsuits all around the country because it produced heart valve problems for many people who used it. And an unbelievable amount of money. They already have lost one case in Texas for $23 million, a jury trial. And there's another one going on in New Jersey, and American Home Products is worried now. After years of its own people apparently delaying information to the FDA about the heart valve problems they knew about.
Well, Juan, we're going to go right now to London to the latest news right now from the extradition trial of Augusto Pinochet. The former dictator's lawyers are shifting focus away from this brutal scheme to target the Spanish judge seeking to extradite him on charges of torture and other human rights abuses. In the second day of an extradition hearing, the 83-year-old general's lawyers argued Spain has failed to tie him to acts of torture and that Spanish judge Baltasar Garzón was motivated by political bias when he asked Britain to arrest Pinochet and hand him over to Spain for trial. Giving us an update each day is Reed Brody, Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch, who's at the Bow Street Magistrate Court and has been monitoring the trial. Welcome, Reed.
Hi, Amy. How are you?
Good. Can you tell us the latest?
Well, actually, this morning, to everybody's surprise, Pinochet's lawyers withdrew the argument that they were planning to make. As you reported, they had submitted papers stating that Spain's request showed political bias and that Spain was found it unacceptable that Pinochet had overthrown Allende's socialist regime. And they said that Garzón had been, quote, purporting to act in a judicial capacity when he started the case and that he didn't conduct a real investigation. Now, these were obviously very inflammatory charges, and not only that, they were dumped on the Crown prosecutors just yesterday, and Alan Jones denounced these as shabby and underhanded tactics. This morning, to everybody's surprise, Pinochet's lawyers, first thing, actually stood up and said they were withdrawing or that they were going to reserve these allegations for a possible appeal. And in fact, the appeals court has a wider scope of jurisdiction here, or it's not actually an appeals court. It would be a court hearing a habeas corpus petition by Pinochet. It actually has a wider scope. But it was quite a setback, I think, for Spain, for Pinochet's lawyers to advance these arguments, and then in the face of what seemed to be pretty universal puzzlement and at these arguments, to withdraw them this morning. They spent the morning, however, hammering away at each of the cases that Spain's prosecutors had put before the court, going case by case, both yesterday afternoon and this morning. They allege that as bad as the acts may have been, that the prosecution had not presented allegations that General Pinochet could be tied directly to any of these acts. They said that Pinochet didn't know who the victims were, that there were no allegations that he had actually communicated with the security officers who had carried out the torture and the like. And they said that under British law, Pinochet could not be held liable for each of these acts of torture without those allegations being made. Then they also went through many of the cases, or a few of the cases, to say that things like prolonged arbitrary detention, fake death threats, or enforced solitary confinement, sleep deprivation, while they may be considered cruel and inhuman treatment under international law, that they don't rise to the level that would make them constitute torture under British and under European law. So that's been really what they've been hammering at for the last 24 hours. They've just finished their arguments. This afternoon, the Crown Prosecution Service, which represents the government of Spain, is going to reply to all of Pinochet's arguments. And this may very well wind up either late this afternoon or perhaps tomorrow morning.
Well, Reid, thanks very much for that update. Reid Brody, Advocacy Director of Human Rights Watch, is in London for the extradition trial of General Augusto Pinochet, former dictator of Chile. Thank you. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move to politics closer to home, Republican Party Chair Jim Nicholson held his long-awaited private meeting with conservative commentator Pat Buchanan yesterday in a last-ditch and apparently futile effort to convince the presidential candidate not to bolt from the party. Nicholson said he warned Buchanan that if he became the Reform Party's presidential nominee, he could end up helping Democrats win the White House next year by taking votes away from Republican candidates. A recent poll shows Buchanan winning 6% of the vote, and most would come from George W. Bush's supporters. Bush has also urged Buchanan to remain in the Republican Party. Buchanan has said he'll announce his decision on October 15th. He's complained the Republican Party has abandoned its conservative principles and blurred any differences it had with the Democratic Party. The word within Republicans is that Buchanan is not expected to stick around. If he leaves the Republican Party, there are no assurances he could win the nomination of the Reform Party, even if he had the blessing of the group's founder, Texas billionaire and two-time presidential candidate Ross Perot. Jesse Ventura, involved with the Reform Party, is pushing for the New York developer Donald Trump to be the presidential candidate. But today we're going to talk about the politics of Buchanan, just who he is, what he said, what he represents. We've got several people on the line with us. Chip Berlay joins us. He's senior analyst at Political Research Associates and editor of the book Eyes on the Right, Challenging the Right-Wing Backlash. He joins us from Massachusetts. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Chip.
Hello.
Well, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of who Patrick Buchanan is and what he represents?
Well, he's a I wouldn't call him a conservative commentator. I'd call him a right-wing demagogue. and he's a person who promotes all kinds of xenophobia, both in terms of a fear of foreigners and a fear of foreign interventions, which makes him an isolationist and a defender of business nationalist interests that like high tariffs and protectionism. But he's also xenophobic around issues of identity, so that he's racist, sexist, homophobic, and anti-Semitic. Now, the reason he gets away with being called a conservative commentator is that the pundits inside the Beltway have decided that since he knows which fork to use on the banquet table, he can't really be a fascist, which is really what he is.
And, Chip, in terms, I was going to ask you that precisely, his very close relationship with so many, especially television commentators and shows that he's on. How did that develop, and why precisely are they so able to ignore what he stands for while at the same time attacking people like Louis Farrakhan or other folks for remarks that pale in comparison to some of the stuff that he's said in the past?
Well, clearly, if he was an African-American who attacked Catholics and suggested that white immigration from Canada would destroy America because of it would dilute the cultural essence of our society, that, you know, he'd be shunned. So the short answer is that certain kinds of bigotry are more tolerable as long as you're genteel and you play the power game properly. He uses a kind of velvet glove rhetoric which hides his actual political beliefs. And unfortunately, I think that there's a reluctance to call him what he is because most people can't define the term fascism. You know, he's not a goose-stepping Nazi. He's a more of the intellectual clerical fascist tradition of countries like Lithuania or Romania. Therefore, we don't see it, and we can't call it what it is, because to do so would mean to peel back theories about what is corporatism and corporate power made state policy, what is right-wing populism, what is ethnic chauvinism, what is anti-Semitism, all of these things which, you know, would open up questions about, you know, why these aren't really fringe phenomena in the United States, but this kind of bigotry is really part and parcel of the American experience.
Chip Berlay is a longtime right-wing watcher and is author of the book Eyes on the Right, Challenging the Right-Wing Backlash. We're also joined in the studio by Steve Rendell, who's with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Steve, you have been following Patrick Buchanan for a long time.
Yeah, I would say I'm going to take a little bit of a different look at this. I think you almost have to feel sorry for Patrick Buchanan. For 15 years, he's spewed his bigotry, his racism, his anti-Semitism, his homophobia on the airwaves, and nobody ever really said anything. He was the first pundit in our record to make it on national television 7 days a week, 5 days a week on Crossfire. He was on McLaughlin Group on Sunday. On Saturday, he would show up on CNN's Capital Gang. For 15 years, he was able to do this with a few voices that challenged him. I want to point out the only time, it seems to me, the only time he was challenged was on the issue of anti-Semitism. Fair, over the years, has put out several different compendiums of his quotes that show that he was an equal opportunity maligner, that he attacks women, he attacks gay people, African-Americans, immigrants, people of color in general, and we also have a special section that shows how he really despises democracy. He, two of his biggest heroes, of course, he talks about Franco. He talks very glowingly about McCarthy. He loves Pinochet. He talks about them in very glowing terms. These guys are soldier patriots. They're Catholic saviors. He's definitely a bigot. But what has changed? Why is that now on the table? And I would submit that now that he is contemplating a move that would sort of upset the little party, the Democratic Republican stronghold on our politics, that now he's upset them to the point where they will pull in these attacks.
Well, Steve, I'd like you to share with us some of the quotes of Patrick Buchanan over the years, but we do have to break for stations to identify themselves. We're also going to take a look at Patrick Buchanan's appeal to some in the labor movement and how that famous picture of him in the last presidential race in New Hampshire standing in front of a closed factory appeal to many throughout the country. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we take a look at the politics of Patrick Buchanan deciding whether or not to bolt from the Republican Party. And then we're going to look at an issue that's very hot in the New York area now. It's the spraying of malathion because of West Nile encephalitis. But it's an issue that's taken place all over the country, from California to Florida. We're going to look at the use of pesticides and the politics of them, and what say do people have when these kinds of decisions are made to spray populations. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we take on the politics of Patrick Buchanan. And we should add that we did invite Patrick Buchanan to be on the show, but they declined his office, at least for now. Our guest, Chip Berlay, who is a longtime right-wing watcher with Political Research Associates and author of the book Eyes on the Right, Challenging the Right-Wing Backlash. On the line with us, Chip Berlay from Massachusetts, Steve Rendell in the studio with us. Steve, we were just asking you to tell us some of the quotes of Patrick Buchanan, and also just who he is, who this media creation is.
Well, Pat Buchanan has a right to brag in some sense. He's been a high-level aide in three different administrations, the Nixon administration, the Ford administration, and the Reagan administration. And one time he was on the air with the founder of the group that I'm with, FAIR. He was on Crossfire with Jeff Cohen. And he talked about how Jeff Cohen and the group FAIR, our group, was way out on the left. And then he said, on the other hand, he was in the mainstream. He'd worked for three different administrations. And it was in one of the few moments that Buchanan was ever challenged for his views on air, Jeff Cohen said, "I'm sorry, Pat, but defending apartheid in South Africa and defending Nazi war criminals are not mainstream American values." But Buchanan comes from Washington, D.C. He was, he was born there in the mid-40s. He came up in a very conservative Catholic background. If you look at his father's heroes, among them are Francisco Franco, as I mentioned before. Buchanan added Joe McCarthy to that. Of course, Buchanan also was a big fan of Augusto Pinochet, who, I guess not ironically, was attended Franco's funeral. But that's where he comes from. And just to get to a few of the quotes that FAIR has documented, FAIR, by the way, on our website at www.fair.org, we have a compendium of Pat Buchanan's slurs and misstatements and really bigoted statements. And we've gone out of our way to make sure that we show how he attacks all kinds of different groups, African Americans, not only Jews, but African Americans, gay people, etc. I would like to point out one thing that shows sort of the double standard that operates here. Many people, it's been brought up recently that Pat Buchanan claims that Jews pushed us into World War II. Jews with too much influence over our foreign policy pushed us into World War II. Well, this isn't new for Pat Buchanan. This is the only thing that's new is Pat Buchanan is threatening to bolt the Republican Party. Before, Pat Buchanan said that the Israeli Defense Ministry and its Amen Corner in the United States were the only ones trying to push us into the Gulf War. In his book, right from the beginning, he claims that the demise, the destruction of Joe McCarthy, was finally caused by Joe McCarthy's taking the advice of Roy Cohn and David Shine, two Jews. Their advice was for McCarthy to take on the army. And, of course, Buchanan finds two Jews behind the demise of McCarthy. But I think this is one of the most illustrative things. Pat Buchanan, in a column in 1977, said that Hitler was a genius with great courage. When he said that, few in the media took exception. Now, I'm sure listeners will remember when Louis Farrakhan said that Hitler was a great man, albeit wicked and evil. I think here is the key, too. If you step back and look at American society, and indeed sort of the media atmosphere, you see sort of the double standard that operates. Pat Buchanan has been able to operate and succeed and ascend ever higher and higher in politics and in media while being an outright bigot, just spewing bigotry. Right now we're seeing George W. Bush beg Buchanan to stay in the party. I would ask, if you turn it around and make that a black bigot, say, if you will, a Khalid Abdul-Muhammad or a Farrakhan, and you had the Democratic frontrunner begging, say, Farrakhan to join the Democratic Party, I think the media hue and cry that would go up after that would basically signal the end of that candidate's career.
Chip Perley, what about this issue of those Republicans who are trying to keep Buchanan in the party? Is this going to create increasing division within the Republican Party, or is this going to have a spillover effect? Should Buchanan choose to stay in on how voters will respond to a Republican candidate?
Well, I think the Republican Party has made its I don't know how to say this because it's so stunning to me that this would happen. I mean, Steve's completely right that this is a gross hypocrisy, but it's become normalized. And I think that, to me, I don't even know how to answer your question. I mean, are mainstream politicians in both political parties these days willing to embrace demagoguery and scapegoating as long as it increases their vote totals? Absolutely. I mean, that's how far we've sunk in our political process. So, you know, it will Buchanan being lured back into the Republican affect vote totals? Only if we're looking at spin control and not caring about the Democratic process. I mean, it's just breathtaking to me that we can have this conversation without, you know, just basically jumping up and down and saying, wait a minute, this is the kind of person that decent societies shun. And to have a conversation about, well, how is this going to affect the vote? I mean, that's appalling to me. I don't know how else to put it. It's appalling that we're having a conversation about, you know, how this is going to affect the real vote total.
I wanted to bring David Bacon into the conversation, who is a longtime labor reporter and programmer at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley. David, you've been following Patrick Buchanan's labor politics. Can you talk about who it is he appeals to, who he doesn't, and what he has to say about the labor movement?
Well, if Pat Buchanan were just a racist and a nativist, it might be kind of easier to marginalize him or to treat him as a marginalized character. But there is one element of what he says that makes him even more dangerous, and that is, well, you have to look at the context. You know, we're going to have an election next year in which both parties agree on U.S. trade policy, essentially. And what that means for thousands and thousands of workers in this country is the loss of their jobs. And people understand that those trade policies are leading to unemployment in this country and to the loss of their jobs. And so when somebody like Pat Buchanan stands up and says, well, free trade is wrong, and he stands in front of a factory and says, you know, it's the administration's trade policies that are responsible for this, that kind of directs the blame. You know, it sort of shows that the other two parties essentially are unwilling to speak about what people recognize as being part of the economic truth of their own lives. The problem with Pat Buchanan is that then he proceeds to point the finger of responsibility not at the corporations really who are responsible for this, but at other workers. He says, well, the reason why you're losing your job is because of immigrants. The reason why you're losing your jobs is because workers in other countries are undermining you, rather than saying it's the, you know, profit-making policies of corporations that are basically taking advantage of it and moving that production. But that is a big problem because of the fact that we have both candidates of both major parties who are wedded to these policies and are essentially in denial about it. And working people in this country, thousands of working people, know what the truth is about the economic effects of free trade.
Could I add something here just for a second? This is Steve Rendell. I wanted to say that in 1996, we tracked Buchanan on these issues, and not only was he the only daily prominent opponent to free trade, which is a big problem in this whole debate, but whenever he was pressed on workers' rights issues, issues like workmen's compensation, minimum wage, he always sort of, he never answered the question. It was clear that he wasn't for the minimum wage, for instance. He would reflexively go back to a position which we called, it's the Mexicans, stupid. So constantly fingering workers in other countries and other workers. He is not, we called him, a phony populist.
That's right. You know, I mean, remember, he was an aide in administrations that did things like, for instance, break the PACO strike and make strike breaking a respected and hallowed institution in this country. So, I mean, Pat Buchanan is not by any stretch of the imagination a pro-labor candidate. I think Pat Buchanan would like to see a country without unions entirely. But in terms of his exposing the effects of trade policies on workers' jobs and appealing, see, that's what he does. He appeals to the economic insecurity that people feel. I mean, we've got a president on the one hand and Republican candidates on the other who are essentially saying, you know, the economy is fine. You know, everything is okay. You know, don't worry about it. There are more jobs being created now than ever before in history. And millions of people know that this is just plain old not true. You know, millions of people know that we're losing jobs all the time. And what's that joke that says, you know, I know we're producing lots of jobs. I've got two of them, you know. It's people know what the economic reality of their lives is. And that's where Pat Buchanan has that kind of demagogic appeal, is that he says, yes, it's true. Your jobs are in danger. And who are they in danger from? Well, they're in danger from Mexicans. They're in danger from, you know, people in the Philippines or in China.
And David Bacon, what does this say in terms of the Reform Party itself as this vehicle that seems to be a way to continue to sort of, as a safety valve for discontent, especially among the right, but even as Perot got some support from other sectors in his two previous runs, basically almost as a, seems to me, a setup safety valve to prevent the formation of any kind of or the coalescing of any kind of significant electoral force or progressive electoral force outside the two main parties.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Juan. I mean, that was what Perot did last time. And in a way, you look at Perot on free trade and Buchanan on free trade, and they sound very similar. Remember the giant sucking sound, right? That was what Perot used last time to basically try and garner the votes of people who were disaffected because of the impact of trade. And again, what Perot did was he pointed the finger not at, you know, corporations like his own, but at other workers. And here's Pat Buchanan doing the same thing. So, you know, I think that this is an attempt to try and have the Reform Party act as a safety valve that, on the one hand, is willing to admit a certain truth about the economic insecurity that working people suffer from, and at the same time point the finger away from those people who are really responsible. And that sort of, I think, is a way of undermining the possibility of other, you know, third parties like the Labor Party, for instance, or the New Party or the Green Party, that say the same thing about the economy, you know, that are say, you know, it's true, free trade is a bad policy, it leads to the loss of thousands of jobs, and the problem is the corporate domination of our society. So, you know, in a way, it's sort of trying to dig the ground out from under, you know, other third parties that would be able to point the finger of responsibility in the right direction.
Yeah, it's a sucker punch is what it is. In other words, you take the real problem of sectors of the American society being downsized and having real economic hardship, and you add to that bigotry that sometimes goes with that, blaming foreigner workers and people of color in the United States. Here's a statement from John Talbot of the Reform Party in New Hampshire. If you close your eyes, it is difficult to hear much of a difference between Ralph Nader on the left and Pat Buchanan on the right. If that's true, then Ralph Nader needs to distance himself from this kind of thinking. I mean, I think there's too many people who are fighting free trade who are willing to sort of close their eyes to the kind of producerist paradigm of right-wing populism, which just blames scapegoats for these problems rather than dealing with real economic and systemic issues.
Let's end with some of the quotes of Patrick Buchanan that really goes back to the beginning of this discussion. When people are tarred with the terms anti-Semitism, racism, etc., who is and who isn't? What are Patrick Buchanan's own quotes, since we couldn't get him on the show ourselves?
Steve well, Rendell. Just let's begin with what's caused the hubbub recently, and that is anti-Semitism. Pat Buchanan is on the record with various Holocaust denial quotes. One time he said that Jews could not have been gassed to death at Treblinka because diesel engines do not produce enough carbon monoxide. When pressed for the source for his allegation, he said somebody had sent it to him. Since then, somebody has documented on the internet a argumentation very much like Buchanan's that makes it look like Buchanan. It's pretty certain that Buchanan got this information from a Holocaust denial newsletter. As I pointed out before, he's blamed Jews for getting us into the Gulf War. Now, in his new book, he claims that Jewish machinations behind the scenes in the State Department got us into World War II. There's very many others. You know, he is credited with having advised Reagan to go to Bitburg, and credited with having written the words where Reagan said that the residents of the SS cemetery at Bitburg, the SS soldiers, were just as much victims as those in the concentration camps were victims. Just to go to some other quotes, in his book right from the beginning, he waxes nostalgically, really fondly, for the days when, quote, the Negroes of Washington had their public schools, restaurants, bars, movie houses, playgrounds, and churches, and we had ours. In a 1969 memo to the then White House advisor Buchanan, urged President Richard Nixon not to visit the widow King, Martin Luther King's widow, on the anniversary of his assassination. He said, Dr. King is one of the most divisive men in contemporary history. He has many others. I would urge people to go to FAIR's website to see a compendium of these quotes on gays. In 1983, Buchanan wrote, the poor homosexuals. They have declared war upon nature, and now nature is extracting an awful retribution. There's many more of these quotes.
That's interesting in light of just recently a controversy that occurred in Los Angeles, a local L.A. station where a gay male couple are the hosts of the show. And he didn't realize that when he was first invited on. When he did, he tried to pull out, apparently. Then they were putting out a press release that he was refusing to go on because they were gay. So he was forced to come in. But then minutes later said he had to leave because he had to go off to, I don't know if it was a Today Show interview or whatever, which they said was occurring many, many hours later.
That's right in keeping. As I mentioned before, he's also attacked democracy. He's not a believer at all in democracy. He is, as I said, Buchanan offered praise for the Spanish dictator Francisco Franco, calling him a Catholic savior. In 1989, he called Franco, along with Augusto Pinochet, he called them soldier patriots. Very, very praising for these people. In his own newsletter called From the Right, he said he attacked the democratist temptation. The worship of democracy is a form of governance. Like all idolatries, democratism substitutes a false god for the real, a love of process for a love of country, which means nationalism. This guy is a strong nationalist. He's been telling us who he is for 20 years. The reason that George Will, hello George, just realized this year, on without David Brinkley, with Sam and Cokie last week, he said that he's discovered that Pat Buchanan has a fascist sensibility. Well, he can't come out and call him.
You've got several quotes here on women. In 1983, November 22nd, 1983 column, you've got him. You quote him as saying, "Rail as they will about discrimination, women are simply not endowed by nature with the same measures of single-minded ambition and the will to succeed in the fiercely competitive world of Western capitalism."
I'm surprised he says that, given his sister, Babe Buchanan, seems to run his right campaign show.
And he's got another one here saying the real liberators of women were not the feminist noisemakers. They were the automobile, the supermarket, the shopping center, the dishwasher, the washer-dryer, and the freezer. This is from his book, right from the beginning.
Yeah, you can see a lot more. You can see a lot more of those quotes if you go to FAIR's website at fair.org.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. We'll certainly continue to follow Patrick Buchanan wherever he goes, either remaining in the Republican Party, as George W. Bush is encouraging him to do, or joining the Reform Party and being perhaps their presidential candidate. Of course, bolting from the Republicans doesn't make him the Reform Party candidate, but it puts him on the road. We want to thank very much Steve Rendell of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, as well as Chip Berlay, author of Eyes on the Prize, Challenging the Right-Wing Backlash. Also, thank you to David Bacon, freelance labor journalist, also with Pacifica Station, KPFA in Berkeley. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. We were just about to go to a segment on malathion spraying that's been taking place in the Northeast because of West Nile virus and encephalitis that has struck a number of people in the area. But we have just been graced by a call from Mumia Abu-Jamal, prisoner in Pennsylvania on death row for about 18 years now. And since it is very tough to get calls through, we want to welcome Mumia Abu-Jamal to Democracy Now! Welcome, Mumia. Are you with us? Well, as you can see, it is very difficult to get a call in. Let's see if we can hear him. Let's see if we can punch him out and then punch him back right in. Mumia, can you hear us? It seems like... Ah, here we are. Here we are. We'll just pick that line right up. Yes, we're right on the air now.
Fine. Well, let's hope it's not any problem today, huh?
Good morning, Mumia. This is Juan Gonzalez.
Hey, Juan.
How are you, bro?
Hey, ¿qué pasa?
Bien, bien. Estoy aquí, luchando.
Yeah, I'm okay, man.
You know, we should say Juan was at the Philadelphia News for
Daily News for many
years. Many years at the time.
Mumia was the president of the ABJ chapter.
Yeah, we homies from the old ABJ, the Association of Black Journalists in Philadelphia.
That's right.
Well, Mumia, we've just come out of a week of activism around your case around the country that started a while ago with Mumia 911, with artists around the country leading protests and demonstrations, rallies, speakouts, poetry readings on your behalf. When that kind of thing happens on the outside, what happens to you on the inside? Is there any reaction from prison authorities?
Sometimes there is. Sometimes there isn't. I mean, now that we've had essentially a whiteout from the corporate majoritarian media, it tends to be muted, and therefore there isn't a response. When there is a lot of press, they get cuckoo, as when Live from Death Row came out, as when NPR went through their thing. And, you know, then they kind of create something, you know, a provocation, anything. So, I mean, we can kind of gauge their response based on how the majoritarian media handles situations. So when they hype stuff, they get hyped here. So they're very responsive to that.
Well, it clearly seems that after the concert that was held in New Jersey, which got quite a bit of publicity, there was a sense, I guess, among a lot of these major media operations that it's better not to say anything because they were drawing more attention to the case.
From a correctional facility.
You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. You know, again, but when that happens, I mean, we have to remember what we've learned from the civil action. Is that they will respond to pressure from the state, from the FOP, and what have you. I mean, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals opinion makes it very clear, even though the lower court opinion does not. That, you know, they respond. When those guys say something, they jump, you know. And I think that may have had some influence on how our last conversation was so truncated.
For listeners who weren't tuning in on that day, when Mumia Abu-Jamal first called in from prison weeks ago, the guards ripped the phone out of the wall after just a minute of him speaking to us. But in the end, you won that case, didn't you?
Well, only tangentially, and I'll tell you why, because there wasn't any case. Even though I received a misconduct, it was administratively killed. I had no hearing, so I wasn't even given the process necessary to prove that the rule that they attacked me under wasn't a rule, you see. So,
Mumia, where does your case stand right now?
We are right now in front of the August Justices of the United States Supreme Court on a writ of certiorari.
What does that mean?
That's a writ of appeal from any court in the United States to the United States highest court, asking them to consider constitutional issues. It's not a trial court, so things aren't tried. But you historically, you try to argue or have the justices consider any violation of the United States Constitution in terms of the process and what have you. And that's where we're at.
And the court must decide whether they're going to hear the appeal, right? So that would be the first step. Any idea how long that might take for them to decide that?
No one knows what the court will do. I mean, you know, you can use prior practice as a kind of rule of thumb. As a rule, they only accept perhaps 125 or, you know, a very small number from thousands of writs all across the United States and American territories. So it is almost impossible to predict what they will do. And because of that, I find it difficult for me to do that as well.
And is there any message in particular you'd like to give out to all the people who listen to this show, who have many of whom have worked very hard for your for a new trial for you and for quite a while?
Yes, a deep felt thank you and sense of appreciation and also a spirit of on the move. We are continuing, that we go on. I don't know if people know this, but one of our sisters, a very good supporter, Susan Burnett, passed over the weekend. She was the wife of Ali Bey Hassan, a real wonderful, vibrant, beautiful sister, and had a long and rugged bout with cancer. But when she passed, she was surrounded, of course, by her husband.
This call is coming from a correctional facility.
And by other people who loved her, Pam, Ramona, Africa, two sisters from the Bruderhof community. And, you know, it was a peaceful passing. But, you know, we're sad to see her go, but we celebrate her radical and resistant life. She was, I call her a force of nature, just a wonderful, powerful, loving, and militant woman who will be missed, but will also be regarded with, you know, a high standard.
We're talking to Mumia Abu-Jamal on death row in Pennsylvania for about 18 years now. Mumia, one of the criticisms leveled against you by your critics around the country and often raised in newspapers is that the night of the killing of Daniel Faulkner, you have never actually described what has happened. And I was wondering if you could do that for us today on Democracy Now.
Well, the reason I've not addressed that is the reason that, you know, my lawyer has said very often that I haven't had a trial. A trial isn't one piece. It's all those pieces. It is the presentation of witnesses. It is the competence of counsel. It is every part and not one single part. And, you know, it's like I've been denied every part and, you know, how can we call that a trial? That's the really the fundament of why you argue for a new trial, is you say that the original proceeding wasn't a fair or full proceeding.
Well, Mumia, even as we're speaking, the first wave of 95 people who were demonstrating on your behalf and were arrested on July 3rd in Philadelphia at the Liberty Bell are going to court in Philadelphia this morning, so that they continue the growing movement that believes that you did not get a fair trial continues to expand around the world, and hopefully it will get to the point where it will be impossible for those in power to deny you that day in court.
What's interesting, Juan, is that this was a demonstration at the very the citadel of so-called American democracy. When you talk about the Liberty Bell, when you talk about Independence Hall and the center of Philadelphia, a lot of people don't remember or don't know, perhaps, that was once the capital of the United States of America. And if you're going to talk about the Liberty Bell, how can you lock people up or prosecute people and, you know, put them through this repressive process for exercising First Amendment rights that are said to be protected and by the First Amendment or any other amendment to the United States Constitution? You know, what we're working with, as always, is not the Constitution so much as we're working with government power, the ability of the government to do what it wishes, when it wishes, and the Constitution be damned. I mean, even when you go through a civil proceeding and something is declared unconstitutional and, you know, a court or a jury decides it's unconstitutional, it doesn't really mean anything. You know, nothing really, really changes. I mean, you get a piece of paper where a few legal jurists and scholars will say, oh, yeah, well, that was unconstitutional. And they slap a few hands and a few fingers, but the state, you know, continues to do what it wishes to do unabated. You know,
this call is coming from a correctional facility.
I think that, you know, those people in Philadelphia should be supported vigorously. What they were doing was constitutional, and larger and more important than that, what they were doing was right. And I think that point should be made.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is our guest from Death Row at SCI Green, which stands for State Correctional Institution Green in Pennsylvania. Mumia, I wanted to go back to this point that I was just asking about and ask what you feel you can say outside of a court of law, failing at this point you having a fair trial, what you can say about what happened.
Well, I can say that everything that has come forth, that is, through the mouths of witnesses, proves, I think, to any fair-thinking person that the trial-in-chief was not defended, first of all.
2 minutes.
And not properly defended, second of all. You know, in the end, it's not important what I say because, there are sworn witnesses who have come forward, who have given their version of the facts. And it's clear that had we had those witnesses at trial, we would not have this kind of result. We would, you know, I wouldn't be speaking to you live from death row, you see. I think that really speaks to the justness, the rightness, the constitutionality, the fairness of the original proceeding before Judge Albert F. Sabo.
Do you think you ever will have your day in court?
We're fighting for it. I mean, what I can tell you is we continue to fight, you know. You can fight and lose, but if you don't fight, you're guaranteed to lose. So we fight, and we fight not to lose, but to win.
Could the death warrant be signed at any point
one
now?
1 minute remaining.
Absolutely. I mean, there's, of course, we're waiting for what the U.S. Supreme Court will do, but like I said before, no one knows what they'll do or when they'll do it. But that would be another front from which to continue to fight, as it's ever been. The struggle goes on.
Well, Mamiya, for those of us who knew you in Philadelphia and knew the important work that you did on the radio and as an activist, there's no doubt in any of our minds that the police knew exactly what they were doing from the day that, from the moment that they arrested you that night, and exactly, you were always marked by them for special treatment.
Well, thank you, Juan. I mean, you know, what we didn't find out until we got a lot of the files is that I was marked since I was 14 or so. So, now we're learning more. I thank you, Amy. I thank Democracy Now! I thank Juan Gonzalez and all the listeners of Democracy Now! For this very precious time.
Well, thank you for calling in, Mamiya Abu-Jamal, and I can hear he's already been cut off. But interestingly enough, our next guest that we were going to have on the issue of Malathion, I think we're going to have to put this discussion off until tomorrow. One of our guests is Mitch Cohen, and he's involved in a lawsuit against the city of New York for the spraying of Malathion, the mass spraying throughout the boroughs of New York and also beyond. But just by chance, he also happens to be one of the people involved in the protest that are going to court. Mitch, are you supposed to be in court today?
I don't know if I should answer that question on the grounds that it may tend to incriminate me.
You were at the protest on July 3rd at the Liberty Bell?
Yeah, I was part of an affinity group, the Clowns Affinity Group, and we were blockading the Liberty Bell SLAM, Student Liberation Action Movement, groups from all over the East Coast, but mostly New York City.
Now, we're going to give you an impossible job, and that is to make a segue. We only have 2 minutes. We'll touch on the Malathion case, but we'll continue it more extensively tomorrow. A segue between your protest in Philadelphia on behalf of Mumia Abu-Jamal and the lawsuit that you, with the Green Party, has filed against the mayor of the city of New York for the spraying of Malathion.
Well, the lawsuit will be filed next week, and there'll be demonstrations all over as well in Friday in Queens and also in Brooklyn, both at Queensboro Hall and Brooklyn Borough Hall at 4:30 in the afternoon. There are demonstrations
about
the intense spraying of Malathion and other dangerous insecticides on the whole population of New York City over and over again. Helicopters have been dive bombing into parks and into residential areas and up and down 125th Street, and trucks are coming with spraying insecticide that's very dangerous, cancer-causing in some studies, and we are planning to do something about that.
There's been an outbreak of, first it was called St. Louis encephalitis in this area. Now they're saying it's the West Nile virus. But whatever it is, what we do know is that Malathion has been sprayed over and over again. Now, this is an insecticide, extremely toxic, that has also been used throughout the state of California, through Florida, in dealing with various pests. And tomorrow we're going to take this issue on and also talk about why the Green Party in particular would sue the city over this issue. Mitch Cohen, thanks for being with us. And I guess
Free Mamiya Abu-Jamal.
We hope your judge isn't listening today.
And Leonard Peltier.
That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! You can get an audio cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion, David Love, and Donna Neiman. Bernard White engineered today's show. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!